Hi, I'm Susan Glasser, and welcome back to the Global Politico.
I think this last week, these last 10 days of him, is the presidency he's dreamed of doing, of being. Yes, oh, there's a little scandal over here. Well, that'll entertain the troops over there. But I look at everybody's begging me to save them from the tariffs, but I'm getting tough and steelworkers love me. And look, Kim Jong-un wants to meet with me. I'll be able to handle this. If you think the last 13 months have been tumultuous, you ain't seen nothing yet.
This week, our guest is Chuck Todd, the host of Meet the Press. And our subject is a pretty simple one that can be boiled down to this. What's it like to be randomly called a son of a bitch by the President of the United States on a Saturday night and keep doing your job? First, a little bit of explanation is probably in order. We've been working on arranging this interview for a few weeks. I've known Chuck for years and consider him one of Washington's best political handicappers, not to mention an excellent and insightful Trumpologist of long standing. I thought we'd talk Trump, the 2018 midterms, 2020 presidential election, and maybe give some insight into covering this most unusual of White Houses amid the chaos and upheaval of the last few weeks. As you'll hear in this conversation that we recorded Friday afternoon at NBC's studios on Capitol Hill, we did in fact cover all those topics and more. We also talked about what it's like to be attacked by Trump and his long-standing obsession with Chuck, which goes back years. The next day, after our interview, President Trump pounced on Chuck again, in fact, calling him a sleepy son of a bitch in the middle of a Saturday night campaign rally in Pennsylvania. The comment came from nowhere, but then again, seemed perfectly consistent with what we'd already talked about the day before. Covering Trump, as you'll hear in this week's Global Politico with Chuck Todd, is a constant high wire act. I'm just delighted to be here with my old friend, Chuck Todd, who is...
Thanks for the old, Chuck.
That means he's as old in Washington as I am. I think we're basically came here
together. Right? I know. It's a reminder that, you know, we're the older generation now, and it's hard to admit to that.
We've talked about doing this for a long time.
Yeah.
But I'm so glad that we're doing it right now. We can mention that you, in your capacity as moderator of Meet the Press, accepted a really big and important and timely award last night, the First Amendment Award. Tell us about that.
Well, it's from the Radio, TV, and Digital News Foundation. They added the D, I want to say, about 10 years ago, correctly so. But the whole point was honoring sort of a this award, just who help sort of defend the First Amendment or encompass the First Amendment. And they give the award to Meet the Press as an institution. And look, it is today's political journalism on television. If you go back and say, where's the cornerstone? If you think of it as a building, right? The first building block is Meet the Press. It really is. Like the idea of a televised press conference. That's really what it billed itself as. America's press conference on the air was the way Martha Roundtree would even talk about it. And so in that sense, yes, it is. I mean, you know, everything we see on television when it comes to political news is a derivative at some point of that first idea of Meet the Press.
Well, it's a hell of a franchise, but it's also a hell of a moment in Washington.
Yeah,
I mean, you referred to it last night in your speech as, you know, that this is our Iraq war moment. What did you mean by that?
So I've been this is something and I've had these conversations with younger journalists quite a bit over the last 18 months on this moment that we're all covering and the importance of getting it right. Like no matter what you think, look, this is there's no doubt about it. This is an unusual moment in our politics, in the presidency, but it's in some ways bigger than Donald Trump. Obviously Donald Trump got elected taking advantage essentially of this divided moment in time that we're in, both culturally and all this stuff. And so
he's a symptom of the crisis, the crisis.
That's right, 100%. But when it comes to our role in this as the press corps, you know, our credibility is being challenged now by the president a lot, by some of his supporters quite a bit. And maybe it's a tactic, maybe it's the same old, same old. But one of their strongest arrows in their quiver is the media's coverage of the Iraq war. And so we can't afford to get a big story wrong basically twice in a decade, you know, twice in, I guess, a generation. The collective press corps coverage of Vietnam and Watergate gave the media its credibility. If we blow this moment, it could be something that we're pay a price for a generation.
I have to tell you, I've been really invigorated as a consumer of news and not just a journalist myself to watch the return of aggressive original reporting to outlets like NBC, CNN. But NBC in particular, you know, MSNBC, you guys hadn't really been in that business.
There's no doubt. And I think part of this is an acknowledgement of platform neutrality, mm-hmm. right? Which is, and this idea of like, it's like we fell into this role for about 25 years of print did the reporting and television did the explaining.
That's right. You were talking about it.
That's right. We helped viewers understand while others did reporting. And if you notice over the last decade or so, a bunch of us print folks went to television. A bunch of print folks either went on air into television or off air into the executive roles. So we came from a reporting background and we're all going, why aren't we reporting? Why don't we do this? And suddenly the barrier to entry to get into this game, you know, for us to compete with the Times or the Post is much lower. And frankly, we have this huge platform where we could grow an audience really fast, on digitally in particular. So that's, you know, and especially look, if we're going to get held accountable for other people's reporting, we might as well be held accountable for our own reporting. You know, it's hard enough to defend your own reporting. It's tough when you're reporting on somebody else's work and you don't know if it's good or bad.
Do you worry at all about that? Do you have the capacity, given the stakes that are so high? I mean, you know, that you don't look at CNN had this trouble with an investigative reporting mm-hmm. team that was building up and not maybe having the editing infrastructure, the procedures in place, or the backbone. I mean, you know, the thing about the New York Times, right, is the ironclad commitment to its journalists.
Look, we have been concerned. I would like to think, and I'm not going to judge how other news organizations have done this as they've sort of spread their wings. I mean, you have us in television spreading our wings into digital reporting, and you have the New York Times talking about starting a TV show.
That's
so,
right. That's
you know, we're all, you know.
And here we are broadcasting on an audio
that's
platform.
Right, on an audio platform. I'm very mindful of this. Myself and another colleague, you know, Daphna Linzer, who I know you know very well, excellent journalist from Washington Post alum as well, she and I work on this very closely together. We try to basically, we say, we're trying to hire smart and grow smart. So we're not trying to just throw numbers at this and throw reporters. And I think that is the danger when you're trying to be a startup news organization, is that you suddenly, I think we have the luxury of being precise, a little more precision when you add a new reporter to this and decide we're going to create a team that is on national security and we're going to create a team here. And you sort of build it slowly. You don't try to be the New York Times immediately. I think the danger that other news organizations have gotten, I think, is just too much too soon
right.
without putting
Throw an
in,
army at the problem.
We are trying, what's our editing process if we're going to add these four? And so we have been trying to grow smart. The other thing is, I don't want to overhire because I've had to lay people off in a previous life. Not at this organization, thankfully, but I've had to do that at previous. It's no fun. And, you know, I'm hoping that we're hiring people and you're hiring jobs on a permanent and a sustainable permanent basis.
Well, okay. So let's talk about that. I mean, Trump is a risk for journalism, but in a way, he's also been a benefit for journalism. First of all, the guy loves the Sunday shows, right? He must be the last guy who talks about the Sunday shows.
He's got that. Now it's getting everybody. Look, there are two ways to look at Trump. If you're a journalist, you can look at him as this thing that's challenging the very institution and the First Amendment, or he is bringing more interest in what we're doing. He is engaging more people in civics. Now, we can have a debate about how it's being done. We can have a debate about all those things, but it's at the end of the day, it's bringing more people to want to learn. So it's an opportunity. We got to think of it as an opportunity to continue to gain credibility with new eyeballs all the time, which is why it is a risk, because more people are watching. And unfortunately, the margin for error is much smaller. We live in a society that roots for failure. collectively. I hate to say that.
That's
on
a
social
depressing
media,
point.
It is, but there is like
no,
for
I think
sport,
you're right. Absolutely.
I think that
the blood sport of politics in general, which has always existed, has also become more tribal, which means that there's
but
more.
But it's blood sport in life.
That's right.
This isn't just, I mean, look at how we collectively enjoy humiliating somebody who maybe says the wrong thing on Twitter, and we decide, oh, this can just, and then, you know, you've seen these extreme examples where somebody tweeted something inappropriate, they get on a plane, they get off, and they've been fired from their job, right? You know, it's like you pile on to the point of so the outrage machine, certainly it makes it where we have smaller margin for error. So as we continue to expand and what we want to do, we got to think about that. Look, when CNN makes a mistake, you and I pay for it. Mm-hmm. When I make a mistake, you pay for it. When you, I mean, the point is, unfortunately, we don't own our own credibility. We're collectively in this. And I think I want all of my colleagues to think about that. Mm-hmm. I think about it every day. I know there's certain things if I say that I might want to tweet, but I know it doesn't reflect on Chuck Todd. It reflects on NBC News. Mm-hmm. Or it may reflect on the political press corps. And mm-hmm. that I don't want to do that. I don't want to hurt somebody else's credibility by making a snarky mistake.
Well, so will the administration, it seems that the president is so focused on Fox, and you have, you know, really a transformation of one network into, you know, people joke about state TV mm-hmm. and the like. How much do you feel like they will participate in Meet the Press, that they are genuinely journalistically engaged? Or if not, does that liberate you to come at the problem from more different vantage points? You know, it used to be in a very access-driven.
Yes, it was access-driven. I tell you, I cringe at the accusation of access, you know, journalism.
Right.
And I understand it. And it's like, look, I, you know.
But that was, but I mean,
there
just to
is
be clear, that was in the past.
That this sense of, well, you want to be, you want to, because the Sunday shows looked at themselves as, okay, they're a conduit for the administration, so we know what's going on. And, mm-hmm. you know, we're there to question them as they come on, but it's some sort of, so yeah, I would say there's less of that. There's less of a feeling of that. And you know, I, if he comes on, great. If I've never interview him again, that's, you know, that's too bad. But, you know, I don't think we should be in the business of begging anything, you know.
Now, President Trump does have he's had his issues with you.
Yeah, I think I've always chalked it up to a couple things. One is NBC's his home network mm-hmm. in hit for him. Okay, everybody, we all grow up with a home network.
Yeah.
I actually, and I'm not just saying this for PR purposes, the very reason my parents went and got it, my mom wanted a color TV. We never had a color TV. My mom really wanted a color TV. She goes, I just want to watch the Today Show color once. And she just wanted to see the Today Show. It was like all about that. And so my dad was a Cronkite guy and a Brinkley guy. So it meant we were CBS and NBC. Trump's just been NBC's his home channel. For New Yorkers, especially of his generation, the Today Show is a home place.
That's
so
true.
So NBC's his home. Never mind the connection with The Apprentice. So he watches. So I've been in his consciousness. And I have, you know, for a long time, he used to call me up and be upset because I wasn't taking the idea of him running for president seriously in 2011.
Uh-huh.
And we would have these half-hour conversations regularly. And I would sit there. And I remember one time with Savannah Guthrie and I, we literally put it on a mute going, does he have other things to do but call? We were just confused.
That's
like,
amazing.
But he does care. And I do think I think it's NBC related. I don't think it's me personally. I just view it as, because he once said, he goes, come on, we're colleagues. I make you a lot of money. Huh. I'm like, what? Like,
that's revealing.
It is more of a, well, aren't we all on the same team? You're NBC, I'm NBC. And I think that that's his – look, he's a transactional mindset. So I think that's what he believes.
Mm-hmm. And so any interaction since he's been
– yes, I've had actually quite a bit of off-the-record mm-hmm. interaction.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Always very respectful. Right. Always very interesting. There was one thing that leaked out on one during a group meeting where he second called me a monster and the other second going, and I love this guy or he's fun or whatever. But it was – He goes, but man, you turn on the TV and he's beating the heck out of me or something. And so it's this, he doesn't want to scorch the earth yet with me.
Mm-hmm. Which is the paradox in general of Trump and the press, which is that on the one hand, there's this unprecedented rhetorical assault near daily, both from him, his press secretary, and yet on the other hand, his level of engagement with
it remains very high.
The one-to-one
engagement is...
Yeah.
you're so unbelievable. I just don't know why you're so tough on me.
Yeah.
Or you're so, you know, don't you think I'm doing well?
Yeah.
What do you think? And then it's like this. It's like you have these the hottest conversation. He's begging for compliments mm-hmm. sometimes. You know, mm-hmm. Is my economy running and humming? Mm-hmm. Isn't this great? You know, mm-hmm. Don't you think I made a good decision with this person? It, mm-hmm. It's always a fascinating way he tries to, and you're like, and I always am careful. You're thinking, I know I'd like to think we're off the record, but I never know when he thinks we're off the record. Mm-hmm.
Well, and then there's the thing with him and his advisors don't seem to know that either, which has gotten him in trouble, you know.
You know, there is a part of this, I do think that, and I think there's a growing, it's funny how you can watch conventional wisdom form. Anyways, feel like, I always say, we all
that's
crap.
That's our contribution to the GMP.
We all crap on and conventional wisdom correctly, right? But but it's conventional for a reason. It's usually true, okay. My joke was at Hotline, we were wisdom before it was conventional. But there is this, you could feel it gelling because I think there's some truth to it that those of us that have watched him very closely, he's getting more and more comfortable shooting from the hip and conducting this presidency by his gut. And I mean, I think this last week, these last 10 days of him is the presidency he's dreamed of doing, of being. Yes. Oh, there's a little scandal over here. Well, that'll entertain the troops over there. But look at everybody's begging me to save them from the tariffs, but I'm getting tough and steel workers love me. And look, Kim Jong-un wants to meet with me. I'll be able to handle this. And that's going to be, if you think the last 13 months have been tumultuous, you ain't seen nothing yet.
Yeah, I'm totally with you on the you ain't seen nothing yet. That, you know, one of the things about Washington elite consensus is that you and I both know it's right for a perilously small moment and then it's wrong, you know, and just figuring out at the moment at which it's right, and all the rest of the time when it's wrong. But in this case, I think both of us have struggled with the idea. People keep thinking there's going to be some normalcy or some routine, and the idea that it might not get crazier has not really entered into people's minds enough.
Well, and it depends what you think is crazy, he thinks is successful.
Correct.
And this is the dichotomy.
Yeah.
So you have a
That's
many
right.
of his West Wing advisors actually come from a more traditionalist point of view. They're you know, that's why you have the Rex Tillersons of the world. These are not negotiations, which is exactly what Susan Rice said they shouldn't be. I mean, there's this conventional view when it comes to the Korea issue, which is no. You talk; they're informal talks. Like they're, and he's sitting there going, "What are you guys talking about?" And he's going back to his gut, going, "I can handle this guy."
Mm-hmm.
This is exactly what he said he'd do. So that's why I look back at these 10 days and think, we're looking at it and saying, oh my God, this is the most chaotic. Who knew it could get, we keep saying this can't go over 11, and it's to 12 to 13. And he's going, finally, it's the presidency I've been dreaming of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really interesting frame to put around it. So back to your role as you're a great interpreter and Trumpologist, if you will. But as a Sunday show moderator, and now you also have the Daily show as well, you have multi-platforms, you have your newsletter
just
as
like
well.
You do.
that's right. But you're not going to get Rex Tillerson and Jim Mattis. In the past, right, you would have mm-hmm. spent a lot of time kind of working the system and, you know, lobbying people.
They don't want to go on.
Yeah.
They don't want to go on. What we have noticed is quite a few people who either feel aligned with the White House or traditionally are supposed to be aligned with the White House or work in the executive branch, don't want to be put in the position of having to contradict the boss or of having to defend them maybe in something they're uncomfortable to defend. So they just say, you know what, not available.
Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting dilemma. Do you have any policies, you know, formal or informal, about the kinds of people that you'll have on representing Trump? You know, there is the issue also of credibility and truth. A lot of people didn't want to have Kellyanne Conway back on after she talked about alternative facts. What's mm-hmm. your view of that?
I try to remove my own personal view of what I think, whether a person is credible or not. And I try to say to myself, I want the viewer to have the White House perspective. Who can this person do it credibly, or is it going to be a rabbit hole and a waste of time? So that's the way I view it. I don't have any singular on any individual person, there's some things that, you would have certain people on because they will go deep on that issue. And then you're like, you're not just going to generically have them on because they're just going to fight you and it's not going to be good for the viewer. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, you know, what I don't want to do is, and there's this happens a lot more on cable, and I'm glad to see my Sunday show colleagues don't do this, is put people on just because you might do something to go viral. Mm-hmm. That's a cable trick. It's a clickbait trick, and we hate that. We know what it is.
We can talk about Sam Nunberg later.
No, but it's not just it's like when I see all the Anthony Scaramucci interviews sometimes at night, you're like, what's he doing? Is he really? But people are interviewing him as if he's been this integral part of the Trump organization. I think there's certain times that he is a relevant interview as sort of understanding maybe Donald Trump the person or, you know, what the New York investment crowd thinks of him. But I think you got to pick your spots. Don't just do it to do it. And I think that's sort of the mindset to have.
Right. So you're not trying to kind of troll us on Sunday morning.
Right. I want to put on there. Number one, I want everybody to feel as if their point of view is represented at some point. And I want everybody to feel uncomfortable for 5 minutes at some point.
But what if they're lying to you?
Look, there's no crime to lie to the press, which has been a dilemma we've all had for a long time, especially when it comes to going deep on the Mueller probe when you ask certain questions. When you interview, whether it's a Roger Stone or a Corey Lewandowski or Reince Priebus, because there's no, and you find out later maybe that they contradicted something, you know, with Mueller, and it's like, boy, I wish I could put them under oath. Mm-hmm. You know, I wish. And so that's I'll tell you this: when I catch somebody lying to me, that's it. Mm-hmm. I never use them as a source again. Mm-hmm.
So they won't come back.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And have you had that happen?
There is not somebody who's lied to me on camera, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But there are people I won't put on because they've lied to me.
Well, if anybody's reporter. Listening to this, consider yourself on notice. No, if you lie to Chuck on camera, you're not coming back.
But let me ask you, Susan, I mean, will you ever use a source again if you caught them lying to you?
Yeah, no, it's a huge problem because we both know that there's no monopoly in Washington. And it's not about party. It's not about, you know, like I was just talking with somebody the other day, interestingly, related to Russia and this investigation about a situation where clearly somebody who's very well known, one of two people is not telling the truth. And these are people that, you know, that you've talked to, right. That I've talked to. You know, if you don't want to talk to anybody in Washington who lies, you're not going to be talking to people.
No, it's true. But I've had somebody who I consider a friend lie to me once, so I won't use them as a source anymore. Yeah. And yet they're still a friend.
Yeah.
In a weird way. But it's like they thought they could take advantage of our friendship.
Well.
And I called them out on it. And it led to an uncomfortable moment. I've let the friendship recover. And this person probably doesn't really. I've never used them or asked them to be a source again.
Do you believe that there is something that distinguishes the Trump administration, or perhaps just the president himself, in the level and degree of their misrepresentations?
No, I actually think this has been a problem that has been eroding or evolving or. Mm-hmm. Metastasizing. I don't know what pick.
Truth eroding problem.
Yeah, I'm trying to. What I'm saying
pick
is.
Pick your metaphor.
Yeah, which is. Trump doesn't have a monopoly on this, but we have had, I would say, over the last 5 years, there's a new younger generation of political operatives that believe myths of mm-hmm. bias, mm-hmm. that believe the myth that, especially on the. One of my concerns is particularly on one side of the aisle, that believe the myth that we're in the tank against them.
Right.
And. To actually try to approach me sometimes with, well, I know you're not for this. I'm like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Like, I always sit there and say, like, but they believe their own. They basically believe the BS that the Roger Ailes wing of the party created. That the mythology that all reporters are against conservatives or all reporters are against the Republican Party. Well, if you say that enough over a 35-year period, you'll get a bunch of people to believe it. And there's a whole new generation of operatives and of staffers who are much more antagonistic to the press.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, while it is mostly a phenomenon on the right, it is a growing phenomenon on the left. And so it's the constant degradation of the press that over time, and you know what? I actually think it will be healthier. I do think in general that the collective press corps in Washington and the Washington power brokers were too cozy.
And the clarification of roles.
Yeah,
is what's happening now.
And it's like, you know, I don't think being at a dinner party with somebody that I cover is a big deal, but I see why it looks bad to others, right? I do think there's something. I'll tell you something I've changed over the last, ever since I got this role, and this was before Trump, this was last year. I'm not going to many Washington events where we're told to, you know, where the old traditional mingling between the powerful and the press. Part of it is I'm just tired and exhausted, and I've got my kids are at a certain age that I just want to go home and hang out with them. But I also think rebuilding the wall is important to the public, and you know, that's something we owe.
It's very interesting you say that. Peter, you know, my husband, who is the chief White House correspondent for the New York Times, that's really his view as well. And he's, again, this predates Trump. You know, the New York Times, as you know, has this policy of not even going to the White House correspondents' dinner. And you know, there's some grumbling about it in the sense that I don't think anybody thinks they're going to be kind of bought off by attending an event like this.
And they're not.
But the flip side is that I think it where it is in clarifying the roles and helping people to understand, you know, that we call it like we see it, regardless of what party is in power. That is the value that you and I grew up with. And
by the way, though, it is true. Once you get to know somebody, you do soften up on them.
Sure.
And you do want to give them the benefit of the doubt because guess what? We're humans.
That's why Donald Trump wants to have those off-the-record interactions.
We're all human beings. We're all human beings. And look, I do try to put myself in the shoes of the people I recover in a human way to understand better why they might have made the decisions that they've made, right? I do constantly think about that. I think about it with viewers. I think about it with the people I cover, with the interviewees, because I think that helps broaden how you ask questions and things like that. But there is something, look, let me put it another way. I think we in the press corps need to not care if people don't like us. I don't care.
Remember that famous scene in Broadcast News where, you know, Albert Brooks is getting beat up by the other kids, you know, future TV news reporter.
Yes.
Listen, 2016, just when it comes to politics, you know, clearly people all around this town clutching themselves to try to figure out, did we just misunderstand how elections are going to work in America going forward? You've always been one of my go-to people when it comes to, you know, that just understanding in a way most journalists don't, the nuts and bolts of American elections and how they work. That's where you came up through the hotline. You know, have we recovered our sense of what how American politics works? Was that an aberration? Has it caused you to do anything differently?
Well, I'll tell you, it has a little bit. I mean, I think that I'll say this. I think we are we're obviously in the middle where I think we're in the middle of a political realignment, but the two parties aren't there yet. Okay, that is a fact, and that is why they're. I think the part of the reason we're in the tumult is that the public's realigning, but the parties have yet to and they're struggling to catch up. And I think it's obviously it'll take the millennials to decide what the parties are going to be. I mean, I think we kind of see an idea, but we may be a good 20 years away before we have a good sense of which party is the party of international realism and which party is American nationalism, right? Some form. Which one's the inward party? Which one's the outward party? Which we always have, and it can go back and forth. There was a terrific piece by Matthew Continetti in the Washington Free Beacon about the comparisons of William Jennings Bryan and McKinley and those coalitions and how what would have happened had Bryan won? Because we have basically Donald Trump is William Jennings Bryan 100 years later.
But he invokes McKinley, which is hilarious,
it
actually,
is funny.
Just the other day.
Right, but it is sort of in that same way. And look, that period where William Jennings Bryan sort of was the populist hero to rural America, the Republican Party became the dominant entity in American the cities and in the urban areas and among intellectuals and elites. It looks like we're going down the other road, except that Democrats aren't quite sure what they are yet. And Republicans are still trying to figure out. So I think we're in the middle of this realignment, which tells me that I think there's still more uncertainty to come. I used to say it's possible 2016 is a black swan. But I also believe we're going to look back on 50 years and look at the fact that we've had Congress change hands multiple times, that we've had nobody can get more than 53% of the vote in the presidency now what are we up to, like seven straight not since Bush 88. We're paralyzed as an electorate. So why are we surprised that our politics are paralyzed? Mm-hmm. And I think that we're not quite sure where to go as a nation yet, collectively, the populace. So I think sometimes people still have to tell us which way they want to go.
So when you look, though, at the numbers, right, if you analyze the mm-hmm. fundamentals, it would suggest that Republicans are in line for pretty much of a thumping, as George W. Bush
Yeah, the question is it going to be a good Democratic year or a great Democratic year? Mm-hmm. I think that's a fair thing to say about 18. What's 2019? What's 2019 going to be with a Democratic House, a Republican Senate, and a Republican presidency? Like, it's probably going to look a lot like the second term of Obama, mm-hmm. which is a lot of noise and not a lot of action.
Mm-hmm. But with Mueller thrown in,
and with the pressure, you know, look, to me, the big wild card of 2018 is the impeachment message. Mm-hmm. Does Donald Trump run on it? Mm-hmm. I always actually have believed that Donald Trump would be most likely to embrace it.
Not saying, the Democrats.
Meaning they want to impeach me. If you give them this, they're coming after me.
Right. If you want to keep me,
make it a referendum on his presidency. Make it a referendum impeachment. What's interesting is I've had these conversations with strategists of both sides. Democrats are petrified of impeachment. Of the impeachment message.
I just did a piece on Jerry Nadler, and it's clear.
Republicans aren't running to embrace it either. Don't get me wrong. But I think they're nervous that the president may grab onto it and put them in a box. But it is interesting that's the hanging meatball that's just hovering over 2018, which is, it's not just the Mueller probe, but how the president politicizes and uses the Mueller probe. Does he try to use it as they're coming to get me? Mm-hmm. And is that the way he gets his base out?
Any early handicapping on people you think might be effective at running against Trump in 2020?
It's interesting to watch Joe Biden be the only Democrat that Democratic candidate in Pennsylvania invited, the only Democrat with presidential ambitions that Doug Jones down in Alabama invited to him. So we have gotten this little Biden Trump preview, at least in Pennsylvania, which feels as if anybody could match up against Trump, right, Biden? But for the life of me, I don't know how Biden gets through the Democratic primary, how he survives what feels as if it's a party that wants to have this debate, that wants to have this, look, we're in an identity crisis, let's figure it out type of debate. I think that party wants to do that. And which means this could go any number of directions. I think the person's first name is not Senator. Mm-hmm. Other than that, I don't know. And I say that because I think the Democratic electorate is going to gravitate to a non-Washington person. I think that's going to be the place to be, even though there's so many popular senators or even former senators or former Washington people sitting out there, a Biden, a Warren, a Sanders. But, you know, I think you're going to see a lot of voters kick the tires on the Steve Bullocks, on Mitch Landrum, on Eric Garcetti, on maybe whoever wins the governorship in Florida or whoever wins the governorship of Ohio. I mean, we may not be talking about the Democrat. We may not even know the Democrat who may end up the nominee in 2020 right now may not think they're running mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. yet. You know, I think it's that – I think the potential to easily – sort of surge on the Democratic side is that great.
It's almost like that a Bill Clinton coming from, you know, Mario Cuomo not running. Kind
right. of I think there's there is going to be, which is why you're going to see everybody run. Mm-hmm. Like if you've ever, you got this guy, John Delaney, nobody's ever heard of him.
There's no downside.
I don't write him off.
Yeah.
I don't write him off. I remember everybody laughed at Paul Tsongas. He announced mm-hmm. 3 years in advance. I think he announced sometime in the late 80s and he ended up running in 92, right?
Of course, you and I are the only ones who remember the Tsongas candidacy, but it mattered
for
us.
Paul Tsongas. I used to do. An invitation. I don't mean. And literally, there are three people who
everybody's
will remember.
Everybody's dad loved Paul Tsongas, right?
Paul Tsongas, I'm not going to be your pander bear.
Pander bear.
But your poor producer here. She's like,
who the hell
I think
is
it's
that?
Funny that he's doing Kermit the Frog. I just don't know why. But yes.
But by the way, Bill Clinton was kind of a pander bear, right?
He was. And Paul Tsongas did sound like Kermit the Frog.
Totally. But
the point is that he was totally dismissed and laughed
at. That's right.
And he became, had he not had his own health issues. He might have taken Clinton all the way to the convention. So I don't laugh at a John Delaney. I think voters are going to kick the tires on a whole lot.
That's going to be the headline out of this podcast. Chuck Todd says John Delaney has a good chance in 2020. No,
but and I also think that it's possible the Democrats go way left with their nominee. Trump alienates this certain. I mean,
right. A McGovern scenario.
Ben Sasse primarying him and making his life miserable. I'm not going to write off the idea of John Kasich as an independent. If you have something that's way left versus right, or this idea that there's this vast middle here, and a John Kasich could convince, say, a Claire McCaskill to run with him, I'm just sort of spitballing here. I'm not saying, you know, where you get this sort of coalition, it's of left-right, but sort of center-left, center-right. We are that. I think particularly millennials are more open-minded about where to go here. There's a lot more opportunity for new candidates and independent candidates to make noise.
Maybe Macron can win.
Macron. Look, that happened there. Now it's more, their system makes it easier for a Macron to come out of nowhere. They have a system that's a little easier to come out of nowhere. But I wouldn't write off a come out of nowhere scenario.
Well, I know you have to go do one of your many other things, which is host a daily show. I want to ask you if you could have anybody on your Sunday Meet the Press. You hate this question. So
No. Go ahead and ask it. I'll admit it.
Just tell me the answer. You hate this question because there's so many people you'd like to talk to.
There is that. And there's always like personal itches I want to.
Kim Jong-un.
Yeah, there's personal itches I want to scratch.
That's who you want to talk.
Look, I really wanted to interview Fidel Castro in my lifetime.
Yeah.
I did. Yeah. I grew up in Miami. He was such a towering figure in how of the politics that I learned. So for me personally, I just missed it. Maybe in the late 90s had I been, you know, had it been a generation sooner, maybe I would have had a chance at it. But that's the one that I wish just personally. But you know, I tell you what my daughter asked for. She wants me. She said, what will it take to get Taylor Swift on Meet the Press? And I said, well, she has to think about running for president. She goes, well, she might. I said, you know what? I'm not writing it off.
So your daughter will end up running her campaign.
My daughter, I tell you, Taylor Swift announced tomorrow. My daughter would, I think, would try to run Virginia for her. That's for sure.
Now, she's a brilliant eighth grader, right?
Yeah, and, just like you're brilliant.
Exactly.
Eighth
grader, yeah. We have a nice
eighth
match.
Graders in common. Yes,
exactly.
What
lucky
a
us.
Weird. Ugh.
My motto.
Teenagers.
Theo is nobody ever loved eighth grade, so it's okay.
That's right. Oh, the drama. And what you want to tell them, you know, this is nothing.
Yeah.
But they don't believe you.
Yeah. Then again, they watch President Trump, and maybe that gives them a sense of perspective. Chuck Todd, this week on the Global Politico, thank you so much. This is a fantastic conversation.
It was fun.
And thank you to all of our listeners.
Thanks, Susan.